Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Talk about her new novel, Goddess of Fire. I think the last time you were here, Barty, was when we did that program called Writing India and the Pacific Northwest. That was in connection with Seattle Reads, the namesake, which seems like yesterday, except it was 9 years ago. So tonight, Barty's going to be in conversation with Seattle University's Nalini Iyer. So first, we thank Elliott Bay Book Company for co-presenting this evening and being here with Barty's book and also one of Nalini's. So we thank the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and finally, this event is supported by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Private gifts to the foundation make possible hundreds and hundreds of free library programs and services and resources, and that amazing Shakespeare's First Folio that is going on right now. So to foundation donors here with us tonight, we say thank you very much for your support. So about this new book, Goddess of Fire is set in 17th century India. It opens with Murti, a young widow who is about to be thrown onto the funeral pyre of her much older husband when she is rescued by an Englishman who turns out to be an agent with the British East India Company. You may have seen Paul Constant's review in the Seattle Review of Books that was later picked up by the Seattle Weekly, in which he called Goddess of Fire, quote, an old-fashioned novel, one stuffed full of romance and adventure unfolding in far-off places and far-flung times. He went on to say, Barty is resurrecting a forgotten woman from history, giving her a name and a personality and a role in her homeland's creation story. Only someone who enjoys a mastery of fiction could perform a time-traveling rescue operation like this. It really is a wonderful work of historical fiction set in the city of the author's birth, Calcutta, also known as Kolkata. So Barty Kirchner, you probably know, is the award-winning author of 10 books, 6 novels, including Darjeeling and Pastries and Shiva Dancing, and 4 cookbooks that many of us have on our shelves at home. She's written articles and essays on food, travel, fitness, lifestyle in such magazines as Food and Wine, Vegetarian Times, Writer's Digest, Northwest Travel, and many more. You may have read her reviews in the Seattle Times or her pieces in the International Examiner. Seattle University professor Nalini Iyer specializes in post-colonial literatures and theory and 19th and 20th century British literatures. She's the co-author of a book, Roots and Reflections, South Asians in the Pacific Northwest. So the format for tonight is Barty and Nalini are going to have a conversation about Goddess of Fire. Barty will read some passages from the book in the course of that conversation. Then you'll be invited to ask questions. At the end of the evening, they're going to both sign books at the front table. And thanks again to Elliott Bay Book Company. And please help me welcome Barty Kirchner and Nalini Iyer to the Seattle Public Library. Thank you.
Can you all hear me?
This mic work? Okay. I want to start by thanking Chris and Karen and the Seattle Public Library and Bharati for this evening. And thank you all to the audience for being here on a weekday night. We know you're book lovers, you're here, so this is fabulous. As Chris mentioned, you're a prolific writer. This is your 6th novel, and writing is not your first career, so perhaps a little bit about how you became a novelist.
Thank you, Nalini. I always wanted to be a writer. And growing up in India, I was surrounded by the Bengali culture. And some of you might know that the Bengali language is very rich in literature. And I was inspired by the writings of Rabindranath Tagore and many other distinguished authors. But life doesn't quite work the way you want, so I studied mathematics. And when I came to this country for higher studies, I got into computers. And that led to a career in software engineering, which I did for many years. But throughout this period, I always read a lot, and I kept my dream of being a writer alive. Now, what happened was, then one day I realized that unless I do something about it, writing is not going to happen for me. So I did what you are not supposed to do, which is to quit my full-time day job. And people told me, don't do that. You know, people wait in line to work for a company like IBM. But I said, no, I have to do this. And I started taking writing classes. And I wrote magazine articles, short stories, got them published. And I also wrote a cookbook, because cooking was a passion of mine in those days. Now, what I did then, I didn't realize it until much later, that these were my transition points from the highly structured world of software to creative writing. And so I wrote my first cookbook, got published. It's called Healthy Cuisine of India. And the publisher liked the book, and publisher said, why don't you do more cookbooks? So I ended up doing 4 cookbooks. And these are for 2 different publishers. And the second publisher was a big New York house. So that was a big break for me. And I could have stayed in that field forever. There are plenty to write about. But there was something in me that was pointing me towards fiction. And I have been taking classes, and I've been, you know, doing some writing. And finally, I finished a manuscript. It was titled Shiva Dancing. And the book got published. And actually, Nalini and I met over that book. I still remember going to your class and talking about the book.
Many years ago, we have a long friendship, yes.
So it's like we have come full circle on that.
Yeah, and then I had the privilege of having Bharati's oral history narrative become part of the book Roots and Reflections, where she really talks about what it was like to be in the Pacific Northwest. So ours has been a sort of a mutually engaged and wonderful friendship over the years. So I really cherish that. And one of the things, I mean, I'm a literary critic by trade, so I, even if my friends write books, I can't turn off the literary critic in me. And one of the things that struck me about this book, as Chris mentioned, this is a historical novel, and your first for 3 novels, Shiva Dancing, Darjeeling, first 4 actually, Sharmila's book, and Pastries, were all about contemporary women, and they are transnational stories, Indian and American, people crossing borders. You went to Japan briefly for Pastries, and then you did a mystery novel. This was your prior one. And then you've gone to the historical novel. The genre shift is very interesting to me. What draws you to these different genres? It takes a lot of skill to shift genres as well.
Exactly. Thanks. Thank you. That's a good question, actually. Switching genre takes a lot of work, simply because you have to know the conventions of the new genre, and they each are different. Also, you have to read a lot in order to know what's going on in that genre, what has been done. Then, so my first big switch was going from cookbooks to novels. That's really a big jump. Within this novel category, first I wrote the first 4 novels were what is known as literary commercial novels. And these are the novels that are completely invent them, and you have a certain amount of freedom. Then I wrote this mystery novel. Now, the mystery novels truly have a skeleton in them, and I don't mean just literally. There is, in the mystery novel, there has to be, in the very beginning of the book, there has to be a crime, and then the main character gets involved in the crime, gets solved, and the criminal gets caught. So that is really what is called the story arc, where the story starts and story ends. It's sort of predetermined, it's usually fixed. Now from there I went on to write a historical novel. And that is also another big jump. Because in the historical novel, to write about a certain period, you have to know that period really well. You have to know it so well that you can kind of imagine yourself living there in that particular period. Also, and that this is very important, the story you want to tell has to fit in the historical context and the historical facts. So these are two really big, difficult things to do. And actually, there's a saying among writers that historical novels take at least twice as long as any other regular novel. But in my case, the characters were in my head for a long time, so I wanted to write about them. And also, one other thing about I should point out is that India is a land of history. History has never left India. Everything people in India think of the present as just a point in this big continuum. So history, you are always surrounded by history. You get out of the house. For example, last time I was there, I was walking out of the house, and then I saw on the sidewalk somebody has put a miniature little temple on the sidewalk so people going to work can stop and worship or whatever. Now, that is something very unusual, but the custom goes way back. So India is always, you're steeped in history, the culture is steeped in history. And if you're writing about India, sooner or later you're going to touch the culture and touch the history.
Maybe before we get into a deeper discussion of the novel, the audience would like to hear you read so they have a feel for the novel.
Oh, okay, great. That's a pleasure. Uh-huh. I'm going to read from chapter 1, and I'm not going to read everything, just say one passage. So this is India, 1684, village of Rampur in Bengal. The day after my husband died, my brother-in-law and his son came to my door. They dodged the copper bowl I had thrown at them and dragged me by the wrist to the funeral pyre. The blazing afternoon sun bore down on my bare scalp and oiled body as we headed toward the river. Tendrils of dust, carrying the smell of death, rose from the earth around my bare feet. A dog howled in the distance. Years later, I'd remember how I had winced from the clutching fingers of Bipin. "Take his land," I said, trying to pull away, "but please let me go. I'll live as a ghost in my parents' home. I'm only 17. His skin rough as a tree bark. Bipin gave my forearm a vicious twist. His foul breath triggered a wave of nausea in my already queasy stomach. "Hold your tongue, Murti. Now that I'm the head of the family, I've decided you're going to be a goddess." A fresh wave of humiliation coursed through my body. The voice of my schoolteacher father shot out from my throat. "You've twisted what our sages prescribed to serve your selfish intent. Abuse a widow, throw her into the fire, and take her property. You ought to be punished, not me." Eyes red from the palm wine he drank, Bipin once again tightened his grip on me. "You, the lowest of the low, a village girl who could pay no dowry? What do you know?" My father had taught me at home. "You learn faster than the boys in my school," he would often say. To Bipin, I said, "Baba might be poor, but he's better educated than you are." "You miserable little wretch." Bipin and his son Jadu were momentarily distracted by a procession of people at a distance, shadowy figures beyond a bank of trees. Gritting my teeth, gathering all my strength, I kicked Bipin, yanked my greasy arm from his grasp, and kicked him again. He slipped and tumbled onto the ground. In trying to help him rise, Jadu let go of my wrist. I ran along the rocky road. Bipin rose, straightened, caught up with me, grabbed me by the neck with a fierce hand, and cursed me under his breath. "2 days with you and my brother is dead? You are a bad woman. We want you dead." Jadu plucked a white kerchief from his tunic pocket and stuffed it into my mouth. "Does that feel better?" he asked with mock concern. I gagged and struggled to breathe as they pulled me by the arm to the public crematorium, a spacious open-air spot facing the river, surrounded by jungles and a few hills far away from the residential section of the village. The place was bare, save for burned logs, piles of ashes, and bone fragments. Several departed souls had recently been cremated here. The stench clogged my nostrils. Father and son pushed me down onto a bamboo pallet placed on the ground next to my husband's corpse. I was already dead and disposable. They stood there, muttering together, occasionally throwing glances at me. I pulled myself up into a sitting position, removed the handkerchief from my mouth, dabbed at my eyes with it, and tossed it to the ground. My feet hurt from the bruises. My stomach heaved and eyes stung. Could I escape my fate? How? Thank you.
One of the points you made earlier, that in India you live with history around you, and those of us who've grown up in the cities like Calcutta or Bombay or Madras, which were where the British East India Company had set up its many centers, even today you see buildings like the train stations, which are fully functional, which are really very, very British in their architecture. You live, it's like multiple periods of history are happening at the same time, and you're living through all of that. So you were raised in Calcutta. You were surrounded by some of these monuments of British Empire. How did those buildings, moments, influence you into thinking about this history?
That's a good question. Actually, all the time, I'd say, I wanted to write this book for a very long time, because going to school in Kolkata, which is the current name of Calcutta, I always wondered about this person, Job Charnock, who was supposed to have been the founder of Calcutta. Now, there's some controversy about that, whether he actually was or not, but regardless, he was a very fascinating character. Job Charnock had a trading post for the British East India Company. It will ultimately to be in Kolkata, but before that, it was a little bit farther away. Now, he was a visionary because he saw the prospects, he saw the potential of this particular region, the Bengal region. And let me tell you a little bit about that. The Bengal province was situated in the Ganges River Delta. And this is the biggest delta in the world, and the soil there is very rich. So as a result, some of the industries such as agriculture, textile, fishing, these things are very well developed in Calcutta. So Job Charnock saw that this was a place where he could really do business. One other thing was, India already had a highly structured society, economy, religion, agriculture, education, all of that were pretty well developed at that time. Now, this region also had one other good point about it, and that was the proximity to Bay of Bengal. So ships can come from abroad, and there'd be a transport, you know, there'd be an exchange of goods. And also, this region also is served by many rivers, and it's connected to the interior of the country also by various waterways. Now, in those days, to do any kind of business, the goods have to be transported to the rivers. Because the land routes were not safe, often there were pirates, roads were not good, so you had to depend on the water very much. So for all these reasons, this region was very much looked favorably by the British. And Calcutta, once it was founded, was the pride of the British. It was a beautiful city, and it became the first city of British Empire and the capital of British Empire for a good long time before they moved it to Delhi. So that's a long answer to your question.
So staying with the 17th century, the British were not the only European powers. So there was rivalries with other European countries, like the Dutch were there, the French were there. How did all of that play out in Bengal?
In the Bengal, okay. Let me back up a little bit and tell you a little bit of this history because it's very interesting. Well, the British did not come to India at first. What happened was around 1500s, the first wave of international trading started. It was globalization. You might think of it as globalization 1.0. Now, what happened was the Portuguese, who were a naval power at the time, they found a sea route to India. And this was around the Cape of Good Hope in the Africa South. So Portuguese found it. Once the Portuguese found it, Dutch also found it. And Portuguese and the Dutch, they went to some islands in the Indian Ocean, and these were called the Spice Islands. They were Sumatra, Java, Borneo, now known as Indonesia. Now, why were they there? For spices. Now, the spices were nutmeg, mace, cardamom, cloves, a whole bunch of others. And why do they want spices? Because spices are very popular in Europe, because spices flavored food, and also because they were used for medicinal purposes. Many of the spices were ingredients for common medication in those days. For example, nutmeg was very good for common cold. And people, there used to be murders over nutmeg. It's hard to believe, but that's the way it was. And there was a saying in Europe that now actually the spices are more popular in Europe than smartphones are now. Uh-huh. So the Portuguese and the Dutch were doing. They had the monopoly over the trading over there, and eventually the British also found the route, and British went there. But the Portuguese didn't want the rivalry with the British, so they threw the British out. So then the British came to India. Now, what was there in India? Spices, of course. India had these spices, black pepper, cardamom, cloves, ginger, and many others. But that's not all. India also had very fine textiles, silk, cotton, and a lot of the other varieties of clothing material. Now, these are also very popular in Europe because in England they had their industry based on woolens. So the clothing was very happy, great for winter, but come summer, it was just unbearable. So Indian silks and cottons are very popular in England. Now, that's not all. Then there was indigo dye, the vegetable coloring, and this blue color was very popular in Europe also. India was a pioneer in coming up with vegetable coloring. And there are, as you can see now, Indian clothing are very colorful, and the household goods are very beautiful and colorful. So not only colors, but prints and designs also were practiced in India. Two more items, one was opium, and the other was saltpeter. And saltpeter was probably the most important of all of these. Now, what is saltpeter? It's a kind of salt that grows naturally, can be found naturally in India. And it's an ingredient of gunpowder. Now, why is gunpowder necessary? Because in those days in Europe, there's always a war going on. For example, during the period of my book, the Third Anglo-Dutch War has just finished, but they knew there would be another war, so they always wanted saltpeter. So the British found all these things. And so they were very happy, and so the India, which was their sort of like their consolation prize, became their grand prize, and ultimately India will become the crown jewel of British Empire.
So one of the most interesting characters in this book is Job Charnock, who is a historical figure and is thought to be the founder of Calcutta, as you mentioned. What did you learn about his personality or his character in your research, and how did you take that historical material and work it into this really interesting fictional figure? So a little bit about what you discovered about him would be really helpful for the audience.
You know, the interesting thing about Job Charnock was that he was very much a company man. He really was very loyal to British East India Company. Now, I'm saying British East India Company because the Dutch had their Dutch East India Company, so to distinguish the two. Now, he was loyal, and in fact, he was also a very honest man. They used to make fun of him as the honest Mr. Charnock. Now, he was honest in the sense that the other British agents that were there working for the East India Company, they would do trading on the side. They would work with the local Indian traders, buy goods, sell them on their own to England, and make money that way. Now, in some ways, you can't blame them because their salaries were very low. But on the other hand, they were not helping the company doing that. And Job Charnock wouldn't do that. And one other characteristic of him was that he really liked India. And he learned the language. He owed Indian clothing, which was really smart of them, smart of him, because, you know, the woolens, the other British were wearing all the breeches and, you know, the coat and the waistcoat and all that, very hot. So he wore the tunic and pants, very light, very good. So he did that well, and Indians really liked him, And he mixed well, and as I mentioned, he learned the languages also. So these are the qualities that helped him adjust to India much better. A lot of the British agents that came, they did not survive India because tropical climate, different food, different water, tropical diseases. So most of them, there was a saying that most of the British did not make more than, they didn't live more than 3 monsoons. That was how difficult it was, life for them. But Job Charnock had a good long life, actually.
Mm-hmm. And the most interesting part about him, which you have woven into this female protagonist, is that he had an Indian wife, mistress. There's some debate in history about her. But she's the person through whom you focus your story. And that is remarkably interesting because she's a historical figure. And what did you learn about her from history? How much did you have to imagine her to create this compelling character?
Actually, I had to imagine a lot because she is not very well recorded. There are just some cryptic mentions of her, and that's about it. So I had to kind of, so that gave me the fictional license to develop her the way I wanted to. And as I wrote about her a little at a time, I found that she was a very strong, capable woman, and she was very entrepreneurial. And she also really cared about her people. Because in those days, the Mughals were running India, and they have generally been good rulers. But the current ruler was Aurangzeb. And he did not have popular support. He was religiously intolerant. He imposed very high taxes. And there was corruption in his court. So he was not very well liked. So the common people were being oppressed by both the Mughals and by the British who has come and been hiring people. They're not treating the locals right either. So this was the quest of Murthy, whose name was be changed to Maria, is how to help her people. And this is what drives the whole plot of the book.
Not only is Murthy Maria a fascinating character, there's another very powerful female character, and that's the Indian queen. And so we have that sort of three-way thing between the Mughal emperor, a local queen, and the British East India Company going on in this novel. What do we know about these small Indian Hindu kingdoms and how they played a part in all of this?
Exactly. That's a good question because the British will start making alliances with these independent kingdoms for their own advantage. Now, many of these independent kingdoms had women running them. Now, both of us probably have grown up with the story of a particular queen called Jhansi Ki Rani, the Queen of Jhansi. Now, Jhansi is a province in north central India, and this queen was very strong and powerful, and I got my inspiration from her. So I have a character called Rani Mata, and that means Queen Mother. And this particular woman, she was running her own kingdom, and she had actually, what happened was, her husband was the king, was the ruler. But the Mughals came and started to invade her fort. So the husband was trying to contain them, trying to fight them off, couldn't, he died. And she saw it from upstairs, balcony, and she came down and took the sword and took over the war from one of her generals. And she fought the Mughals off, they went away. But she was constantly in fear of them coming back and taking over. So this is a character that's very strong but vulnerable and powerful, and she became a role model for Maria. Because Maria was a very young girl, she didn't have anybody to look up to, not among women, and this was the person she really relied on. And they had a very good friendship going for the rest of their lives. And so that was how the whole thing came about for me.
Maria's story is very interesting. You read the opening section from your book, and there is the stage is set there for the deplorable and controversial practice of sati, which was the burning of widows on their husband's funeral pyre, which unfortunately occasionally still does occur in contemporary India. So sati was a pretty complicated topic in Bengal, and you address it. So what were some of the challenges? What was the historical context? How did you work that into the novel in terms of how you wanted to represent, you know, Indian culture and all of that?
Yeah, sati is a funeral custom, and the word sati, S-A-T-I-R, S-U-T-T-E-E, that refers to both the woman who undergoes it and the custom. Now, how did it get started, something so horrible, something so barbaric? Now, it goes way back to ancient India. Now, there is this story that goddess Sati jumped into the fire, gave her life willingly to protect her husband, god Shiva, from humiliation. Now, there are many, many interpretations of what that humiliation was, why she did that, but she was immortal, she's goddess, she was brought back to life. Now, that doesn't matter. What happened was this myth persisted somehow. It was taken up by upper-class Hindu men. And the reason was this. In those days, the men married women much, much younger. So by the time the men died, he would have left some wealth and properties, which should rightfully belong to the widow. But the relatives of the husband, they would try to get the widow out of the way so they could take over this property. So what they did was, they made, now usually Brahmin priests are always part of the funeral ceremony. Now they made the Brahmin priests made this a custom and a mandatory part of the funeral. So this went on, even though at the time the Mughals were running India, they had outlawed it actually. But they couldn't enforce it, because India has so many villages. India is a land of villages, and there are so many of them that the law enforcement couldn't go to every single one and stop them. So this went on for a while. But around early 1800s, there was a religious reform movement among the Hindus. And this reform is, they did many other things, but one of the major accomplishments was getting rid of this particular custom. They said, this has to go. And the way they enforced it was, they formed watch groups. These watch groups would go to every single funeral and make sure that women are not being harmed. So this went on for a while. Then ultimately, when the British took over India, or much of India, they outlawed it also. So slowly, gradually, it all went away. And once in a while, you hear about it, but there's no real proof that it's still going on in India. And it's not just Bengal, there's Bengal, Gujarat, Rajasthan. There are many of the other provinces this was going on, really.
So you also have some British women characters in this novel. And I know later Victorian fiction has done a lot with these single women of modest or not so, or even poorer women, but of gentle birth, would be shipped off to India to find husbands in these British administrative settings. And so you did some research into this. What did you learn about this? And because you incorporate this in the novel.
I found that this custom was going on. And actually, even E.M. Forrester, in his one of his passages to India, mm-hmm. I think he also has this right. group of British women coming to India. Now, the reason these women came to India is because, as you suggested, these women didn't have really good prospects of marrying high. These are not high-born women, and they couldn't expect a really good marriage in England. So they would pay a certain amount of money to get into a boat, and these boats will take a certain amount of women, 20 or more, and bring them to India. Now, these women had the visions of Orient. You know, in those days, India was called Orient. Anything east was Orient. So they had these visions of silks and jewels and servants, palaces. So they thought that if they went to India and married somebody, that's how they would live. So they would land in India in one of the ports and go to one of the British trading bases. And they would arrange a beautiful evening of lavish dinner, flowers, music, dances. And there would be these British agents that were there. They're young, single. They were not allowed to bring either girlfriends or any family at all. So they were lonely and they would want to meet these women. So there would be this mixing that go on, and sometimes there would be romance developed, sometimes not. More often it didn't happen. And these women would go back to England. It was called returning empty-handed. And that was a matter of shame actually for these women, these poor women. But this went on, so I have, it's sort of a tragic comedy that I have in my book, a little bit of the couple of these women that came to have their story in there.
Yeah, and in that regard, I mean, in your novel, we do see that if the Indian women were subject to horrendous practices like sati from, and you know, property gouging from their families, the English women didn't have it any better either, because they both had to work their way through. Their identity was through marriage and having a husband who could support them. And so it was very interesting to see both those stories sort of paralleled and juxtaposed in your novel. I think it was a very useful way of thinking about the position of women in the 17th century. The audience has been very patient, but I'm thinking maybe they have some questions for you, and I'd be happy to repeat the question. So the question was, while sati has been abolished, the condition of widows in contemporary India still remains difficult because they're stripped of life and certain rights and so forth. And what's happening about that right now?
Okay, well, I'll tell you exactly what's going on now. When I go back now, I find, you know, among my relatives there are widows. It's totally changed. Now, it used to be that the widows could only wear white, and they were not allowed to eat any kind of animal flesh, only vegetables. And actually that worked out on their behalf. Because by eating, not only they ate vegetables, they were given only scraps, all the stalks and the skins of vegetables and leaves are, and these are the healthiest parts of the vegetables. Mm-hmm. So there developed a cuisine in Bengal called the widow's cuisine. It was really, really tasty. For example, when I was growing up, my grandmother, she was a widow, and she had her separate kitchen because she, you know, it was so vegetarian. I mean, we're all more or less vegetarian, but she was too vegetarian. And she cooked so well that we'd go to her kitchen and finish off everything. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it was very difficult for widows in those days. But now I don't see that very much. Widows were not allowed to wear any jewelry. Now they wear jewelry. They wear colorful clothing. So it's changed. And a lot of widows are getting married, too. So that's been happening very much, especially in Calcutta. I know many widows that are remarrying.
The women were supposed to be thrown on the pyre with the husband, right? So wasn't there a huge opposition to such a horrible practice?
It was in the 19th century. There was the British missionaries, now those who saw this, were working towards abolishment. There were stories of women being rescued from the funeral pyre and so forth. And then during the anti-colonial nationalist movement, there was in the 19th century a very strong, particularly in Bengal, a very strong reformist movement where they were trying to reform ideas around caste, around the age of consent for marriage, around widows, widow remarriage, sati. And so between the British and progressive Indians, there was a move towards bringing about reform around these issues, like child marriage, like sati, which did lead to the abolishment of sati. But in 1986 in Rajasthan, we did see a resurgence of this practice because, you know, people were trying to reclaim their culture and their tradition, which often happens on the bodies of women. So this was a rather problematic thing, but the government, Rajiv Gandhi's government, tried tepidly, if you will, to manage the situation, but it led to tens of thousands of people showing up in Rajasthan to worship this woman's temple and so forth. So there's a certain glamour associated with the honor of a woman who dies on her husband's funeral pyre.
Okay. I have another question too. So Calcutta being the first, you know, city that was developed by the British, how come it has never contributed economically for the economic well-being of the region?
I'm not sure I understood the question.
You say how Calcutta hasn't contributed to the economic...
Well, because it was developed by the British so early on. Mm-hmm. And today it still stays rather poverty-stricken region of India. And so I'm just wondering that shouldn't have there been well-being, economic well-being due to the fact that...
Was Calcutta contributing... Given that it was the capital of British India and so forth, he's asking, today it is a poverty-stricken area, so right, why is it not contributing to the economic well-being of India?
Okay, that's a very long story, but what happened to Calcutta was, Calcutta was very militant from the very beginning, but a short time after it's been founded, people in Calcutta are much more militant than the rest of India. They wanted freedom from the British right from the beginning. So Calcutta became so militant that they decided that, the British decided that they would not keep the capital there, they moved it to Delhi. That will de-emphasize Calcutta's importance. Calcutta was also a center of ideas, literature, and very progressive thinking. It was more like, actually Bengal was more like California in many ways, you know, the progressive thinking there. Now, then what happened, there is a, because, and then when India became independent, still that feeling was there towards Calcutta that it may be too militant, it may be too hard to control. And so the center never really helped Calcutta very much. So as a result, and then what happened in 1971-72 when Bangladesh was formed and the war was really right near there, it got an influx of refugees from Bangladesh. And that really changed Calcutta because already there were maybe 10 million people and they got maybe 5 or 6 more million people. And the city just couldn't handle that.
In fact, some of the refugees from 1971 are still in refugee camps and not yet been resettled. It's been almost 44 or 50 years.
Well, you mentioned that I think the characters had been in your head for a long time before you wrote the book. And I wondered which characters and what... I've heard writers say that before, and I'm curious as to what the characters were saying to you early on or what you were hearing from them.
Okay. Yeah, actually the characters were in my head for a long time, but until such time I have done enough research and I knew the setting of the story and the surrounding and the events really well, characters didn't speak to me because I had to feel like I was actually there. There came a point after when you do enough research, you feel like, oh, yeah, I was living there. You know, I know exactly what the streets look like, what the houses look like, what the people talk. Then it started to happen, but that didn't happen from the beginning, unfortunately. That's why it takes so long to write a historical novel. It's just that you have to understand and know that period so well that it becomes very familiar to you.
I have a history question. You mentioned that one of the things that the British find in India is opium. Uh-huh. And they grow opium in India and they ship it to China. And in return, they had tea and silver and the triangular trade. Was there a drug addiction problem in India at that time? Or how did the Indian people escape being a drug addict to opium during that period?
So it's a question about opium, right?
Opium and the triangle. So they grew opium, shipped it to China, brought back tea. What Amitav Ghosh has written about in his trilogy, right? So the question is, so we know that opium addiction was happening. They developed opium addiction in China. Mm-hmm. Did opium addiction happen in India as well, is the question?
Not at the time, not very much. It was, if it happened at all, it was limited to only the people that worked with it. most of it was just sent out of the country. So it was, as far as I could see, there was no opium addiction in the particular areas that I have researched. They weren't there. Let me think if there is... No, I don't think I saw that. Uh-huh. Now, what has happened, though, like, for example, in Afghanistan, they have been opium grows very easily there. It did not become a problem until such time. The demand was so high, and they were growing so much of it. Now, Afghanistan has a very serious problem with opium, only because they're growing so much, and the people that are around it all the time, very soon they become affected.
Yes, I have a question. So I haven't read your novel. I would like to read it in the future. But since it's a historical novel and you have characters that I assume are British also, so my question is basically two questions. How do you maintain historical accuracy? For example, when you do the research, you have to be, quite concerned about the accuracy of the historical events that may have taken place. And then how did you research the British characters?
Well, just by reading a lot and reading and double-checking, making sure what I read in one place also correspond with some other places. I think it's just broad general reading. That's the only way you can do it. There are some people who give it to historians to read and verify that everything was accurate. I didn't do that because I am more in the service of the story. Story is more important to me than a lot of historical facts. I want to make sure all the broad facts, all the important facts were there and they were accurate. But I didn't go into real nitty-gritty details to make sure everything was right. I wanted to make sure the story reads well, moves smoothly, and the fact that it works. So that's what I did. And what was the second part?
So maintaining the historical accuracy and the accuracy of the British characters.
British character, that was very interesting because that's not so easy to find. Again, it's the same thing just by reading books. I found that Sudello Library, University of Washington, that has a really a good Indian collection, South Asian collection in general. And that's where I went for the books. They had, the reason is that they had very good funding in the 1960s for Indian books, and so they were well stocked. And at a certain point, the funding went away, and so they were gone. But the old books are still there. The books I needed were still there. And some of them are very old. I used to go to the shelves, and I'll pick up a book, and I'd be afraid that it will fall apart. It's that old. And it looked like nobody uses them except myself, you know? And other thing was that there were a lot of, and this was a little bit later, but still are applicable, travelers that came to India from England. They wrote books, and those books were useful. The British brought a lot of painters from England to paint pictures of India, because India was so beautiful in those days. And oftentimes, by looking at those paintings, I tried to figure out what was going on. So, you know, you have to go to a lot of different things to find your material.
Did you find any inspiration from other authors that write on the same subjects, like V.S. Naipaul or Salman Rushdie?
I generally read Indian authors, so I don't know that they particularly inspired me or helped me to write this book, but in general, I read both fiction and nonfiction by Indian authors. There are some excellent books. So I'm inspired. I think my inspiration always comes from within rather than from outside, because unless I have it from within, I won't be able to sustain it for very long.
My question was also the same type of question, but if you drew on other like types of art or music or movies even, there's a wonderful movie called Water. It was written and directed by Deepa Mehta. Uh-huh. Beautiful movie, and it's about an 8-year-old widow who is having to go to like a colony or a leper colony, which is what was done in the 30s, I think it was the 1930s. Yeah. And I'm wondering if you used any other kinds of artifacts.
She's asking about Earth.
Deepa Mehta's Water, the one that she did about widows. Whether something like that might have inspired you to think about the life of a widow and so forth.
That was a much more contemporary movie. That was taking place in early 1900s. Mm-hmm. So mine was so far in the back. Actually, the period I was writing about, not much have been documented, which was good and bad, because at first I just went to so many different places and I could only find little bits of things, but I couldn't find enough material. So that also gave me artistic allowance to do what I wanted in many cases. Yeah, but the period after that, 1700s forward, much better, historically much better documented.
Marty, was there some research in India also, in Calcutta?
It's very interesting because I actually went to India several times during the writing of the book. Now, this is what happened. This is my personal connection to the book. The period, the place in India where the British East India Company had their trading post is a town called Kasim Bazar. And it's just a strange coincidence that when I was young, my family and I lived in a town which was very close to Kasim Bazar. It's the adjacent town. And we used to go to Kasim Bazar all the time. And at the time, I didn't think anything of it. And the Ganges River I mentioned, I used to go bathe for the Ganges and walked and saw the historical sites. Then much later when I was writing this book, I found that, well, this was happening in Qasim Bazar, and I was, you know, it's a historic town, I've been there. So that was really interesting for me to think about and really helped me sort of write that particular town, write about that town.
So thank you very much for being such a lovely audience, and thank you, Bharati, for very wonderful insights on your writing process and the novels. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank
you.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.